Well, it's just a few seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore today hosting Juneau Afternoon. I've got a wonderful lineup of guests coming on a day when we're seeing a little bit of snow here and there. We had scattered snow showers this morning out in the valley and I think downtown, and tonight we're looking at cloudy with a chance of snow, lows 20 to 30. So that's the outcome of the weather. In just a few minutes, we'll be talking to Kyle Pickett and Roel Simonson about a program that they're doing tonight as the kickoff of the UAS Sound and Motion presentations. Deb Rudis will come by the studio to tell us about her lecture at Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. She's talking about Attu Island tonight, and tonight. And we'll talk to Sandy Fiscus and Rick Iannolino. They're hosting a Q&A session about fetal alcohol syndrome. We'll have a free concert this weekend. I think it's tonight. By This Hope at Centennial Hall, so that group will come join us, and we'll have some folks to tell us about the Luna Fest, the film festival that has been here in the past several years and is back, set of films that benefits cancer.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Warm weather is making the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race in Alaska more risky than usual. The race kicks off today. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
The average temperature in Bethel, Alaska for the month of January is 7 degrees Fahrenheit. So mushers in the Kuskokwim 300 race usually take the frozen Kuskokwim River as their trail. But reporter John Active of Bethel says the weather's not cooperating this year.
It was raining. Cats and dogs in Bethel. We had a lot of snow on the tundra, and the river froze over nicely, but then it started raining. And what happens is the edges of the Kuskokwim River fill in with water, so it gets kind of dangerous.
Active says race organizers have created alternate routes over land to help ensure the safety of the 28 mushers entered this year. Because the Kusko 300 is a qualifying race for the Iditarod sled dog race, and with a purse of $100,000 for first place, it draws top mushers. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The incoming U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs Chair Maria Cantwell announced recently a Native woman will serve as staff director for the committee. Mary Pavel is from the Skokomish tribe and a graduate of Dartmouth College and the University of Washington School of Law. Pavel was one of the first Native women to be made a partner in a national Indian law firm, and she's the founding president of the Native American Bar Association of Washington, D.C. Cantwell says she's an expert on tribal law and policy. Presidential inaugural events are kicking off this weekend in Washington, D.C., and continuing through Monday. Native Americans from across the country are participating in the parade, like the Native American Women Warriors and All Native Women Veteran Color Guard, and the Navajo Nation Band. That's the 2011 New Mexico parade the Navajo Band marched in. The band was formed more than 8 decades ago and has been in 3 presidential inaugural parades. Nearly 50 members of North Dakota tribes will walk the parade route. Prairie Rose Seminole is the group's organizer.
Members from all 5 tribes here in North Dakota, and we make up a pretty diverse group from 7-year-olds to 63-year-olds coming from all walks of life. We've got veterans, we've got teachers, we've got doctors, we've got students, we've got college students. We have a Gates Fellow. We have, some people who are traditional medicine practitioners, and just a great group of folks. So very diverse group.
The group was chosen for successfully engaging Native Americans in 2012 local and national politics. Seminole says they're excited to participate.
It's a huge honor. We're all really deeply honored and humbled to be not only invited, but to represent our tribal nations within our state. It's incredible to be able to welcome our president and vice president into their second term and to just be there within that moment with thousands of people representing our nations and our state.
The North Dakota group will be blogging about their experiences at ndtinauguration.areavoices.com. On this day in 1958, hundreds of Lumbee tribal members broke up a Ku Klux Klan rally in North Carolina. Armed with weapons, they chased the KKK from Lumbee country and stopped them from spreading their message of hate. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. This is a court-ordered legal notice for Native Americans. The Cobell Indian Trust Settlement is approved. If you believe you might be included in the settlement, you need to file a claim by March 1, 2013 to get a payment. Information is available at the website indiantrust.com or by calling 1-800-961-6109. That's indiantrust.com or 1-800-961-6109. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
About 6 minutes and 19 seconds after 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and my first two guests are a couple of really interesting guys. I'm sitting here with Kyle Wiley-Pickett and Roel Simonson. They're doing collaborative efforts to with the Juneau Symphony Orchestra, and Roel has done a number of visual pieces, and so this is a conversation you're going to have tonight up at the university about the process of doing
right.
So tell me a little bit about the process.
I should say, this is Kyle here, I should say that, you know, Roel and I have worked on a number of these collaborations, and the reason that we're giving this talk tonight at Egan is that we are currently working on one of these collaborations for the Juneau Symphony's 50th anniversary for our concert next week. Some years ago, 10 years ago, 10 years ago,
just about
10 years ago, yeah. I went to Roald and with an idea, and you know, Roald has been a filmmaker for a long time, and I said, I want a particular film with our symphony concert that will involve photographs taken by kids in Juneau and various. Well, that's all I said, actually. Photographs taken by kids in Juneau, and then Roald took that much farther, and that was our first collaboration. Was what we called the Juneau Our Town Project.
So this is where you gave a whole bunch of school kids cameras, right?
Yeah, I think there were like 400 cameras that were passed out, disposable cameras, and the kids were instructed to take pictures of our town through their eyes, and it was really wonderful. I mean, just to say a few words about these photographs that came in that the kids took is, you know, by the time you add them all up, there was thousands to choose from, and they had to be winnowed down, and so it meant looking at every one of them, and every one of them was good. They, in a weird way that I guess you can anticipate to be so, is they're just so sort of natural and instinctual and unfettered that whatever they're looking at and taking a picture of, it's kind of fascinating. And in the end, like choosing them, it involved questions like, okay, this one has a lot of blue, now I need one that has red. You know, I mean, it was just...
Because you can't do it on content.
You can't, they're just, I like to always say, though, too, you know, just as an example of... That after getting all these assembled, I could have done a whole film and video project called Girls with Guinea Pigs.
And I think someday you should probably still do that project.
I'm behind it.
and of course, we played that film at the 40th anniversary of the Juneau Symphony. And so it was 10 years ago, because we're on year 50 right now. And since that time, Roald and I have done a whole bunch of things. And we'll talk about some of those other projects tonight, but there have been numerous other projects, both here in Juneau and with my other orchestra, the North State Symphony in California. And so, you know, we thought this would be a good opportunity to talk a little bit about that process. We're going to show the Juneau Our Town film, which people haven't seen here locally for, well, probably about 10 years.
Yeah.
And then we will also show the North State Symphony Our Town project that Roald did last year for me in Northern California, and same music, but a very different result.
But
very
different group
film.
Of kids. Yeah.
Different group of kids, yeah. Different yeah. community, and it's kind of a wonderful contrast in what the same music can do.
Yeah,
with different visual images and yeah. create a really different emotional content. I think.
So, Roel, you took these kids took still pictures, right?
Yeah.
And so you made those into film. Is that?
Well, the thing is, it very quickly became more exciting and clear that it shouldn't just be a slideshow of these pictures. If it's our town, like the first sort of idea that came in, even with the Juno one, and then expanded it with the North State Symphony is. Okay, let's do it kind of microcosm and macrocosm. The microcosm is the picture of the kids, you know, playing with their Walkman on the school bus. And then I got footage flying around Juneau above in an airplane and the ice fields and Eagle okay. Crest and skis. And so it would kind of go back and forth.
Uh-huh.
And in order to do that, it actually had to be made into a live film, you know, that was continuous. So it really wasn't a slideshow,
uh-huh.
you know, very, very quickly once deciding to put actual live video footage in it.
Yeah. And we did something different in North State, but we're not going to talk about that now because we can't give away everything that's going to be on the talk tonight.
No, otherwise who would show up?
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So the talk tonight, we should say, is at 7:00.
7:00.
Okay. And which of the venues are you in?
At the Egan Lecture Hall.
Oh, you're going to be in the lecture hall.
Yeah.
There's a big screen in there.
Big screen, yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So okay. we'll show you know show some examples there, and it will be you know we'll have some of the examples of the films. We'll talk about our process, and we'll make sure there's enough time for people to ask questions and talk to us a little bit about that.
Now, you're using a piece of music. When you came in, you handed me a CD of a piece of music that you're going to be using tonight. Is that
actually the CD is that I handed you is Copland's Appalachian Spring, which we will be
right.
playing on the symphony concert next week.
Yeah, okay.
But
so.
the Our Town project used Copland's incidental music for the play Thornton Wilder's play Our Town.
Oh, okay.
And so it is a Copland score. And then actually the project that Roald's working on right now, I'm also using Copland music, and that is his suite from the Tenderland. And, you know, I love Copland. I have a great love for Copland's music. It really resonates with me. It has a nostalgic quality to it, kind of regardless of what the content is. And, of course, when you're doing something like Our Town, that is a totally nostalgic piece. So, I mean, you have a composer who leans in this nostalgic direction doing nostalgia, and then you add Roald's film, which is, you know, these images of children in our city and our community and the beauty here. It's just it's almost overwhelming, really.
It does feel that way. Yeah, it's a deep pleasure.
I have a question about timing.
Yeah.
How closely, and this is really addressed to both of you, but maybe to Roald more than no, yeah, anyway, how closely do you have to study the timing? In other words, do you have images that are in your film that you want to appear at a particular point in the score?
I would say that that's one of the main things that Kyle and I have developed as working over the years is it's very precise. It's to the beat very often.
Ah.
And so that's it really depends.
How do you coordinate it?
It's a real challenge. I mean, we've gotten better at it.
You're watching the film while
you're
directing.
Yeah, I'm watching
the
film while I'm directing it, and we've done it in a variety of ways. There have been times when Roald has played the film, where he's able to pause it and release
okay.
it.
Okay, yeah. Uh-huh.
But we don't do that anymore. We haven't done it for a long time.
Yeah, it just now really kind of depends on sort of working on it
and
doing rehearsing and
it's
and you can sense it actually.
You can sense it, and you know, my job as a conductor is to do pace, regardless of whether there's a film. I mean, that is my job as a conductor, and I've always been a little bit surprised. I don't know why I'm surprised, but when I time my concerts and my performances, they're all within seconds. You know, so we do Mahler's Second Symphony. It's 74 minutes of music, and you know, we come in within 30 seconds between mm-hmm. multiple performances, and so. You know, once you've really established for yourself the pacing that you're going to do, it is repeatable. But it's a challenge because, you know, if you said, okay, if I said, Pat, just right now, without looking at the clock, in 9 minutes and 30 seconds, I want you to snap your fingers. I mean, that's basically what we're doing here.
No, you got more clues than that because you know the visual that's coming and you know what's going to happen.
It does. But the upshot is that something that happens at 3 minutes and 30 seconds is going to affect whether we're going to make it at 9 minutes and 30 seconds.
This is
going
to be a fascinating
talk tonight. Yeah,
well, we've got to get people to it. I've got a wonderful panoply of guests, and you guys, I could talk to you all day, but
we can't do that, unfortunately.
So one more time, you're at 7 o'clock tonight.
Okay, 7 o'clock tonight,
right?
Evening at Egan, the Sound in Motion series.
Right, and the concert.
The concert is next Saturday and Sunday, 8 o'clock and 3 o'clock, Saturday night and Sunday. And also the Juno Symphony is having a chocolate truffle tasting at the Rookery tomorrow night. Saturday night, tomorrow at 7 o'clock, and there's still tickets available, and you probably don't want to miss that.
Tyler, you know how to tempt people.
That's right, you really do.
Thank you.
And that is Evenings at Egan is out at UAS, Egan Library.
Okay. Right. Egan Lecture Hall.
Lecture Hall. The Lecture Hall. Good. Thank you. Looking forward
to it
tonight.
Thank you very much, Pat.
Thank you.
Music by Aaron Copeland in the background, and tonight a conversation up at the campus with Kyle Wiley Pickett and Roald Simonson about incorporating film with symphony orchestra concerts, the two of them having done a number of collaborations along that line. But Juno, you got choices tonight. It's going to be tough. My next guest is going to tempt you into learning some information about the easternmost and westernmost points in the United States. Well, almost. I guess that's a different island. But anyway, Deb Rudess is here, and she's talking tonight out at the fireside presentation at the Glacier Visitors Center about the island of Attu, which is the site of... Well, there were two islands actually involved, but it's the only place that the Japanese ever actually defended during the Second World War. They captured the island, and there was a fierce pitched battle that killed about 6,000 people out on the island. And I guess they left behind some souvenirs, and that's the subject of your talk, right?
Yes, you've done your history very good. Most people don't realize that. Of course, there was a battle on Kiska, too, but when the U.S. forces came, the Japanese had already left, so it was mostly booby traps and friendly fire.
Yes, yeah.
So because I'm an environmental contaminant specialist and work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I get to go to some pretty unique places, and Attu being one of them. So I do quite a bit of work with the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, and as many of you know, most of the Aleutians are part of the refuge, and Attu being one of them. So because it is a national wildlife refuge and open to public access, we have concerns of the contaminants that have been left behind from World War II. And not just contaminants such as oil and PCBs, but also lots of hazardous things such as unexploded ordnance.
Yeah, some of these contaminants can blow up in your face.
Yes,
yeah.
And blow you up totally.
Yes.
So, and there has been a lot of work done on the island as far as categorizing what's out there, trying to map it out, to kind of determine the severity of some of these contaminants and hazards, and some of the piling up of some of the ordnance and burning and exploding them has been rather unsuccessful, and it's been scattered about past the areas where it's been where it's been congregated.
Now, the Attu was originally populated by the Aleuts when the Russians came, but they were all evacuated from the island.
Right. In the
except
early,
for, I
yes.
think, what, 70-some-odd who were captured.
Actually, less than that. And yeah. There's a census that the, or a survey, I guess, that the Russians took in the early 1800s, and they said there were about 100 Aleuts living there then. But in 1934, there were only 43 Attuans there and two U.S. Teachers that were there to help.
Mm-hmm. And our communication specialist and a teacher.
Well, yeah, and yeah. So that's debatable whether, you know, whether they actually worked for the government or who.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the fellow died during the Japanese invasion, and everybody was taken captive and brought to Japan. So that was the end of the village at that time.
Actually, I thought at the end of the whole thing, there were a number of was that from Attu, but it was from the whole chain. There were a lot of Alaska natives who were brought to the Southeast Alaska and put into essentially internment camps.
Right, they were relocated.
And then relocated
out of the
at the end of the world, mm-hmm. or at the end of the war.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But all the people on Attu, unfortunately, were taken to Japan.
So there is no population that's endangered by these explosives that are out there.
There's no human population, but of course, there's lots of fishing vessels that stop there. There was a Coast Guard base that just closed there 2 years ago. It had a staff of 20. It was a Lorraine station.
Yeah.
And then we do get commercial birding groups because Attu, being the westernmost islands, it gets a lot of rare species of birds, mostly Asiatic accidentals, and it's a very big deal to go out there and go birding. And when you see people paying thousands of dollars for a trip like that, you realize, oh, these public members can be walking around all over the place. And they don't always see the signs or actually heed them.
So it sounds like your job, to a great extent, is cataloging.
Yes, it's pretty much documenting what's out there. I'm compiling lots of the other information that's been gathered over the decades and putting it all together into a rather large document for the refuge to use. And right now, though, we're very happy that the Army Corps of Engineers, who's responsible for these formerly used defense sites, or FUDs as we call them, has gotten the money for cleanup actions. And so that is going to start taking place in the next year or two. It's in the planning process right now.
Okay. When we talk about cleanup of something like this, you said that there had been attempts to explode these munitions, but it resulted in basically scattering them. Is that because something blew up and nothing, and the rest of the stuff didn't ignite?
Well, some of it probably did, but we don't go in there and check those out. It has it to us as well. So there's one large site that's over 340 acres.
Ooh.
And as I mentioned, this is National Wildlife Refuge land, and so we are responsible for public safety on it as well.
Right. You have a really tricky job, don't you?
And I've only actually been out there once for a two-week stretch, and I'm hoping to go back out this summer. We'll be going out with the refuge staff on the Fish and Wildlife Service vessel, the Tekla, which is based in Homer. When I went out last time, I went out with the Coast Guard and got to stay at their facility, which was quite interesting, being the only female with the 20 Coast Guard staff that were out there.
Deb, you at the beginning of your conversation, you characterized yourself as an environmental contaminant specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I know your focus tonight is on Attu, but in a job with that title, you must have worked with some really interesting things.
Yes, a lot of my work, of course, is in Southeast, since I'm based in Juneau, and so I work with mining issues, I work with harbor dredging projects, any kind of pesticide use issues and proposals. There's quite a variety that when the pulp mills were still active, I was involved in those projects as well, but down in Sitka and Ketchikan, because my sort of area is all the way from the northern part of Southeast up by Yakutat all the way down to the southern part of Southeast.
What's the background that you had to bring into this position?
Well, I'm a wildlife biologist, and then I have expertise in wildlife toxicology from various college courses.
Okay. And I imagine there's ongoing training because there's ongoing contaminants,
and lots of on-the-job training. And actually, one of the bigger parts of my job, but at least not this year, is oil spill response. So I did spend a lot of time on the Gulf spill. And when I first moved here, the Exxon Valdez spill happened 2 months after I moved to Juneau.
Welcome to Alaska.
Yes, that became a major part of my job, at least for that year. I got to go to some amazing places, though. It was quite the experience.
Yeah. It's awfully pretty up there, but it wasn't when you were there, I guess.
There's a lot of black oil. It was very disheartening and really devastating to see such a beautiful area. And I got to travel all over to map the extent of oil and did a lot of mortality surveys on birds, et cetera.
It must be difficult on a personal level to kind of maintain an attitude of professionalism and maybe something like fairness when you're looking at this stuff and you know what it's going to do to the birds and the,
oh,
and
yes.
the other animals.
Oh, yes. You would actually like to scream obscenities at the responsible party.
Yeah. Well, I'm hearing
but
that.
I would never do that.
No, you impress me as a very sweet person who is probably capable of screaming obscenities at their responsible party, but maybe behind closed doors.
At least not in public that I can think of.
So what will you show folks tonight?
I have some pretty amazing photos. Some of them were taken by other staff when they were there on really sunny days when I was there for that 2 weeks. We didn't have too much sunshine. As you know, the Aleutians can be really wet, windy, and gray, even more so than Juneau, but I think the Aleutians are just gems. They're just amazing islands, and I'm just sorry that more people can't visit them. But I'll have lots of pictures that are of nice scenery, but I'll have lots of photos of what we've seen now that's left as contaminant and hazardous waste issues, and with lots of maps to show where these activities of World War II took place and what's left now that the World War II activities are over.
Are you going to present some of the history?
Just a little bit. I'm not a massive history person as far as the knowledge. There's a lot of books out there with a lot of good information, but I will go over some of the salient details of what happened where.
It's a really fascinating story, and one of the things that we had here in Juneau for quite some time this last year was a standing display at the museum.
Actually, they were my colleagues, and I worked with them on that site.
It was a wonderful, wonderful show. I mean, it was just amazing to see what this piece of history that we kind of know very little
very
about.
Very little, and in fact, I was in New Orleans a few years ago, and I went to the World War II History Museum, and there was nothing on the Aleutian campaign. And I wrote them a couple of letters, and they said they just didn't have room at this time to present it, which was very disappointing to me.
I'm always amazed when I'm talking to someone from outside, and in the course of conversation, it'll come up that the Japanese actually invaded Alaska. Usually it comes because somebody's asking a question about why they build that highway up there, you know, and you get to it and you say, well, it was to refuel aircraft, you know, because we were sending them to the Russians, but it was pushed as hard and fast as it was because of the fact that the Japanese had moved into Attu and set up camp. Yeah.
It's amazing how fast some of these operations happened during World War II. Yeah. I mean, when you go out to Attu and you see this airstrip and you think, wow, they built this in 3 weeks or 6 weeks. Some of these things just happened almost overnight.
Yeah.
With considering the terrain and the weather and how ill-prepared the troops were to go out there, they didn't give them the proper equipment. They didn't tell them what kind of climate they were going to.
You're
going to
do a great talk tonight, this afternoon, or this early this evening and late this evening.
Yes.
You do two talks
there.
That's
correct, 6:30 and 8 o'clock.
6:30 and 8 o'clock. So you can, folks, you can come listen to this at 6:30, or you can come listen to it at 8 o'clock, which means that with this crowded Friday night, maybe you can get to two of the events that we're going to be talking about on the show. Deb, thank you so much for sharing with us what you're going to be talking about. We really appreciate your expertise and the wonderful things that you're probably going to show it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
You bet.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 18th of January, 2013. It's the birthday of the physician Peter Mark Roget, born London, 1779. Retired from medicine when he was 61. Spent his retirement coming up with a new system of classifying words into groups according to their meaning, which gave us the thesaurus. Roget's thesaurus first came out in 1852. It's the birthday of the author of Winnie the Pooh, A.A. Milne, born London, 1882. It's the birthday of the poet and journalist Ruben Darío, born in Nicaragua in 1867. A household name all over Latin America, very difficult to translate into English because he used the rhythm and structure of French poetry to write poems in Spanish. It was on this date in 1896 the X-ray machine was first exhibited. Heinrich Hofmans, a Dutch physicist, built a machine out of spare parts. It took very clear images, but they came at a terrible cost. Exposure time was about 90 minutes, and the total dose of radiation was about 1,500 times greater than what is used today. So the experimenters and their subjects suffered from radiation burns and hair loss and cancer. Many people ended up having to amputate the hands that had been X-rayed. It's the birthday of Thomas Watson, born Salem, Massachusetts, 1854. He was Alexander Graham Bell's assistant who helped him invent the telephone, though he never got much credit for that. It was Watson who was on the receiving end of the first telephone call when Alexander Graham Bell said, "Watson, come here. I want to see you." Bell was a professor at Boston University at the time. Watson was 20 years old. He worked at a machine shop. It was Watson who fine-tuned the telephone. He invented the ringer and also the ability to hang up the phone when it wasn't being used. He invented some early switchboards. He worked with Bell for 7 years, and then he went off to do something else. He tried farming for a while. He opened his own machine shop. He became a shipbuilder, ran the biggest shipyard in the country in 1901, then went to work mining, and finally discovered his great new passion, the stage. He joined a Shakespeare company. He started out with small parts, worked his way up to bigger ones. Thomas Watson said, "Never before had I felt such a constant freshness, exhilaration, and capacity for work and study." He formed his own theater company, and he wrote stage adaptations of Dickens's novels. And it's the birthday of the man who invented barbed wire and thereby changed the face of the West, Joseph Glidden, born Charlestown, New Hampshire, 1813. He was a farmer. He settled in DeKalb, Illinois, where he figured out how to bend little pieces of wire into barbs and to work them into longer strands of straight wire. The invention of barbed wire made Joseph Glidden a millionaire. When he died in 1906, he was one of the richest men in America. Here's a poem for today by Sylvia Plath, entitled Child. Your clear eye is the one absolutely beautiful thing. I want to fill it with color and ducks, the zoo of the new, whose names you meditate, April snowdrop, Indian pipe, little stalk without wrinkle, pool in which images should be grand and classical, not this troublous wringing of hands, this dark ceiling without a star. A poem by Sylvia Plath, Child, from the collected poems of Sylvia Plath, published by HarperCollins, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
27 minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. I have a crowded studio at the moment here. Sandy Fiscus, Rick Iannolino, Lavina Van Sickle, and Lou Seepy are here to talk about an event that's coming up on Wednesday, January 23rd. It's a question-and-answer session on FASD. Who would like to talk first and tell us about what you're looking, what your event is set on? Lou?
Yes, I would love to invite this special event is for folks in Juneau who are interested in learning more about FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and it's for people who would have any questions, family members who might have children who are affected, or nieces and nephews, or cousins, or brothers and sisters. The event is a free event. It includes a dinner, and we'll have a question and answer session, and we have a wonderful team from the FASD Diagnostic Clinic who's going to be leading the event. So there'll be lots of time for question and answers. Child care is provided and dinner is provided. And it's on Wednesday, January 23rd from 4:30 to 6 o'clock p.m. The location for the event is at our Center in Lemon Creek, and that's the Learning Connection at Greening Park. So it's in the Greening Park Apartments, apartment number G49, and in Lemon Creek. And we would love to see anyone out who has questions about FASD, either people working with people who have FASD or anyone with relatives.
Who's the sponsoring organization for the event?
It's CIRC. Okay. And the FASD Diagnostic Clinic.
Okay. And the other folks that are here, what's your role in relationship to this event?
I'm Sandy Fiscus, and my role is, as part of our clinic, I'm the parent navigator. And so I interact with families, go to their homes, help them fill out forms, talk with them after they go through the clinic.
And Levina?
I am a family literacy instructor, and I work with Lou at the Greening Park Center.
And Rick?
And I was a coordinator for the Juno FASD Diagnostic Clinic. We don't have currently the clinics running, but we're trying to reconstitute it. And so I'm a part of the clinic, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much for alerting us to this. 4:30 on Wednesday, January 23rd at the Greening Park Learning Connection. This is a question and answer session on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, a major problem in Alaska. And anyone who has questions and answers is more than invited to show up. Thank you. Was there another thing you want to, okay, thank you very much, folks.
Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
That's the architectural design class at Clark Middle School in Anchorage, working on their current project at the end of a regular school day. The bell rings and kids scatter, but a few stay to talk about the work this class did last year. These students worked with real architects to help conceptualize a new park space in their Mountain View neighborhood. Here's their teacher, Heather McIntyre.
The first step that they really wanted to was to come up with a theme for the park. They didn't just want to throw in a bunch of random play equipment. They actually wanted it to be drawn together. And more of, Mountain View community has quite a few playgrounds, but they don't have a real artistic, relaxing place. So that was kind of what they were looking for. And the kids were working together, and they came up with this global theme that ended up being the main tie-in of the park to celebrate the diversity of Mountain View. And I think the final term for it was Global Village.
14-year-old Philip says he had fun working on the project.
And what did you think was the most fun part?
It was when we were designing and building and thinking of what to put in the park to make it more amusing for the little kids to have fun on.
The park includes performance space as well as community artwork. The teens asked the student body to decorate ceramic tiles that will be displayed at the park, and more than 100 kids made designs. 14-year-old student architect Jacob says it will be cool to see the park once it's done.
It would remind me of all of what we went through and all the fun that we had. If I see people out there playing with it and seeing them having fun, it would make me have fun.
I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
It's about 22 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore hosting Juneau Afternoon today. And again, in the second of these little marathons, I have four guys in the studio. And they're all from a group that is going to be doing a concert at the Centennial Hall, I think, tonight. And this is a group called This Hope. They started out in Soldotna. They're now based out of Atlanta, Georgia. And they sing amazing harmony on Christian music. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pat. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I said just before I started this thing, I know the name of the group, but I don't know your individual names. So who have I got here?
Yeah, so this is Micah.
And you sing?
I play keys and sing all kinds of different background vocal parts.
Okay, and?
I'm Daniel. I play bass and sing.
Okay.
Dave, I sing baritone and guitar, acoustic guitar.
Okay.
Yeah, we all sing. We're basically a singing group, but then we all play too. I play some percussion, and we kind of mix it up. We sing some a cappella stuff. We sing some with instruments, so every song kind of has a different look. And we all switch around on parts too.
There's a fifth guy, right?
There is.
Yeah, he's setting up at the Centennial Hall right now.
And his name is?
His name is Tim.
Okay. Yeah. And you all started this because you were attending the same church in Soldotna. Actually, some of you, I think, have come into the group later, but you were all kind of formed around this one church in Soldotna, right?
That's true. We all basically grew up together in Soldotna and over the years went to the same church. So just Soldotna Bible Chapel.
Okay.
And so we just started singing in church together, and several of us sang together at Soldotna High School in the school choirs. And so ministry just kind of grew out of those years together.
At the end of the interview, we're going to hear a sample of your voices, but I wanted you to characterize your music because you're not, we've got, three Christian radio stations in Juneau, and a couple more that play the occasional gospel piece. So we've got a real broad range of contemporary Christian music.
Sure.
But I wanted to know how you fit into that. Would you guys play, for instance, would they play your stuff on Kayla?
Yeah, maybe, because we sing a pretty broad variety. One of the things, because we sing in the church, we're singing to 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds, and so that means we're doing all kinds of stuff. You know, you'll hear something that'll sound like Barbershop, and you'll hear something that you hear on K-Love in the same concert. So it's kind of hard to define us because we do a cappella and because we mix it up so much, but contemporary Christian would probably be the closest thing that I would say, even though it's pretty broad.
Okay, now by now the silver slug has broken down and is in the ditch someplace, right?
Yeah,
these guys left Soldotna in a school bus, basically, I think it was, right? Called
basically,
the silver
yeah.
slug, and
yeah.
that was how you got down to
yeah.
Atlanta.
Yeah, that was the nickname. We've been through two or three buses since then.
You got something more modern now that you're not having to stop and fix the brakes
yeah,
on?
Yeah, we have a knack for wearing out buses, I think.
So. Well, you had to park that one at the tops of hills so you could get it started
right.
rolling down.
We did.
Right?
That was a distant memory, but that was an exciting tour.
So where all do you play now? I saw a reference to some folks who'd heard you in Sacramento, and you're running out of Atlanta, so you're probably all over the South.
We're all over the country.
Yeah.
So somewhere between 150 and 200 concerts a year. I would say half of those are in the Southeast, and then the other half are all over the country and in different parts of the world. We've been to Cuba, we've been to the Ukraine, we've been to Romania, we've been to Spain and the Canary Islands, and then pretty much almost every state in the Union at this point.
You guys made a connection with a fabulous Romanian songwriter.
Uh-huh.
And there's a YouTube piece of you doing one of his songs.
Yeah.
That's really got some
Nicolae
Moldovan lyrics in it. Yeah. I'll tell you, that's a rough piece.
Micah wrote that one after we met him, just from experiencing his life and what he had been through and what he had seen and what he'd experienced for the name of Christ, and it was.
Romanians put him in prison for 5 years, right?
They absolutely did, and it was a life-changing day for us to spend time with Nicolae.
Yeah. Yeah, and when he went into prison, he wasn't really as committed a Christian as what happened. Is that your story in the song, or is that real?
Well, the idea is that, his story was that he was put in prison for writing Christian songs in the 1950s. And so, I think that his faith was strong, and it was basically the reason why he was imprisoned. So the tug was, just understanding and trying to reconcile, trusting God and doing this, and yet here you are separated from your family. And what came out of that whole time was this prayer that he said that he prayed every morning for decades, was for God to break his plans so that God's plans could be accomplished through his life. And so that was just an amazing concept. And so the song is basically kind of framing his life story and then tying in that concept of surrender.
Submission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It must be... I wonder, I've been to church and groups have come in, like you guys do when you go into a church. There's got to be a mixed set of feelings in the congregation because they have to sing every Sunday, and then you come in and it's like, this incredible concert, And next week, we're going to go back to the choir.
Yeah, it's really not fair. It really isn't.
It can't be, because you've got such a smooth sound that it's got to knock them down when it happens.
I guess there's a balance there, because we spend a lot of hours fine-tuning this certain specific set of songs. So it's kind of a specialized niche that we're in, and we can focus more on just this set of songs. Whereas if you're leading worship and you're having to sing songs every week, it's definitely a little bit of a different focus. But
well, and for us, you know, the focus and the point of what we do is we are praising God and lifting up His name through the medium of music. And so it's fun for us. It's a joy for us to really hone the craft and do our very best at lifting up the name of Jesus Christ. And I think when you come to a church, I think people are drawn in, because we're not trying to show off. We are trying to make we're boasting on the name of Jesus Christ. That's what it's about. We're trying to lift His name high, and hopefully even tonight, the concert tonight at Centennial Hall at 7 o'clock, it's all about Jesus Christ, and our purpose from beginning to end is to boast on His name, make Him famous, because anything we've got, He gave us. Our voices are just normal voices. We practice a lot, but it's about Jesus Christ. And hopefully, when you come to a concert with this hope, you come away going, wow, we serve a great God.
Yeah.
And that's what the focus is.
So what time tonight?
7 o'clock 7 at p.m. Centennial Hall.
Centennial Hall. Okay. There's a little fee, I think, to get in, right?
Nope.
It's free.
Free concert.
Come on in. I think they're going to be taking a love offering.
Yeah.
But that... Don't let that stop you. Come and just have fun seeing God.
Okay. Hey, thank you so much. Let's listen to the sound.
No!
called This Hope. They're performing tonight at Centennial Hall, 7 o'clock. The concert's free. A lot of things going on tonight. My next guest is going to tell us about a thing that I think is also going on tonight, and that is tonight is the night of the Luna Fest. So tell us what's happening.
Hi, I'm Caroline, and I'm a volunteer for our Luna Fest Film Festival. This is the fifth year we've been able to host this film festival in Juneau. It's billed as a film festival by, for, and about women. But we like to say that it's for anybody. It's for women, men, children. It's a series of films. We have 10 films this year. They're curated internationally. They're all about short films. Most of them are around 10 minutes long. I was able to preview them. They're beautiful films made by women filmmakers, usually featuring, you know, women's stories. And it's a really positive way for the community to get together, watch some good movies, and support a good cause. The fundraiser supports the Juno Pro-Choice Coalition and the Breast Cancer Action Fund.
This film festival was actually, it's a national film festival that's promoted by the Luna Bar, the folks who make Luna Bars, right?
Yes, absolutely.
There's a wonderful, on the website that talks about the Luna Fest, there's a wonderful little thing about the fact that women like to go to movies together. So what would be more natural than to raise money for breast cancer by putting together a film festival?
Yes, exactly.
So I think it's a wonderful thought. So what are the films we'll see in the thing this year?
Well, I'll just talk about a couple of my favorites. The first film you'll see is it's a film about a woman who pioneered bicycle frames built specifically for women. She has been a biking enthusiast her whole life and was really frustrated by the fact that women, all they really had were small men's frames when, you know, their bodies are kind of are different. So she just took the initiative and in her basement got an acetylene torch and just started building bike frames.
Yeah.
And so it's her story. And she's a really cool gal, a real inspiration. And now, I mean, she's a successful bike designer with a company and a brand. And so that's a really cool story. Some of them are animated. Some of the stories there are true stories like that, and there are other stories that are very almost magical. They're not all of them. They really run the gamut. They're all really positive, but I cried mostly, you know, happy tears when I previewed the films. But great, you know, if you're emotional when you watch sensitive movies, bring your hanky because you might need it.
Now, this is films about women, but you're not closing the audience to only women, right?
Oh, yes. All the men that I know that have seen the films have really enjoyed the evening. And it's a community event. People bring their husbands and their boyfriends and their sons and their friends. And I've never talked to a man or a younger man that haven't enjoyed the films. I make all of my guy friends go, and they've all enjoyed it. They even sometimes admit to getting a little teary during some of the films.
We have to sneak it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Yeah, you have to, you know, kind of say.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So there's a silent auction tied up to this as well.
Yep,
right?
we have some great stuff, donations from local artists and local businesses. I know when some of our hot items, we have some volunteers have offered to cook some dinners. We have some really good chefs that we know, so those are always popular items. So hopefully get a little extra fundraising. And
so the purpose of the event is to show a bunch of really entertaining and wonderful films about women, but the money that's collected for the event goes for support of both the local things that perhaps some people who even are in the throes of cancer don't know exist. There's an amazing collection of services in Juneau, Alaska, for people who are afflicted by this disease. I know personally a little about those things. So this money goes to support what kinds of things?
Well, the money goes to two places. It goes to the local organization that it goes to is the Juneau Pro-Choice Coalition, which is, it has both a political and an educational aspect. We've been focusing on the educational, just increasing health services, reproductive health services specifically to women in Juneau. The other beneficiary of the fundraiser is a national group, the Breast Cancer Action Fund. And what's interesting about this organization is that they're dedicated to researching and eliminating the environmental causes of breast cancer. Environmental can mean anything from pollution in the water to maybe strange chemicals that's common in, maybe women's perfumes, that something that hasn't really been investigated. But a lot of cancer groups kind of focus on treatment, and that's we absolutely need that. But what's interesting about this group is that really it's looking at what can we change about our lifestyles now, about the products that we use, about our, about the environment that we live in, that can actually help prevent cancer and keep people healthier through their whole lives.
The focus has to be on prevention.
Absolutely.
Because very simply, I think our medical response to cancer is in many ways, I was going to say it's at its best, but I'm sure no doctor would agree with me totally about that. But so much has gone into the response to people who have cancer and what you do with that situation, but preventing it from happening in the first place is absolutely the fight that's next for all of us.
And so, there's so much we don't know about the products that we use and a lot of the chemicals, and a lot of them are great, but it's just there's a lot of work to be done, I think, in understanding of the chemicals that are part of our daily lives and how they affect our health in the long run.
So the LunaFest, it's a film festival, women's subjects. The money that's being collected is a fundraiser for cancer research, particularly into environmental causes of cancer. And the films begin at?
The films are at 6:30. We recommend everybody show up a little earlier, obviously, to get a seat. The doors open at 6 p.m.
Okay. And the doors are located at?
Oh, it's Centennial Hall. At Centennial Hall. It's
okay.
Going to be
so
busy.
So it's
going to
be
tonight.
Crowded
yes.
in Centennial Hall.
Well, that's
Hall.
Good. It's, I know.
Where
I love...
are you in the hall?
Well, now that you mention it, I'm not exactly sure which of the – I assume they will have it divided.
Oh, so they're going to divide hall, and you'll be on one side.
Yes,
and probably
I assume that's how it's going to go because we usually use half of the hall, so I actually don't know if we're going to be on the north or south side now that you mention it.
I've interviewed today on this show. I've talked to Kyle Wiley-Pickett and Roel Simonson, who are going to give a wonderful talk out on the campus tonight. Deb Rudis about a talk she's going to give up at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. She's talking about the pollution on Attu Island left over from the Second World War. And then we just had This Hope, this group that's going to be singing at Centennial Hall tonight doing a concert, and now the LunaFest. Isn't it wonderful to live in a town where on Friday night it isn't a question of, gee, should we go to the movies? It's a choice, and the choice is amazing this weekend. It's really going to be a great weekend for all of these things. Thank you so much for telling us about LunaFest. I hope you have a big crowd. It'll spill over a little bit. Who knows? It'll probably be an interesting evening at the event. Music, as they say, is a thing called two cellos intuition, and the two in intuition is a numeral two. Interesting. 4 o'clock forecast just broke here a couple seconds ago. Weather Bureau is now calling for mostly cloudy with isolated snow showers, lows 20 to 30, coolest in the wind sheltered areas, and east winds 10 miles per hour. And then Saturday, mostly cloudy, highs around 31, east winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, and Saturday night, mostly cloudy, slight chance of snow late, and the lows from 26 to 32 degrees early, with temperatures rising overnight, east winds 10 to 20 miles per hour Saturday night. You're in tune with KTOO News. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau, and in the valley in Auk Bay, we have a retranslator that translates us to 103.1 MHz, K276 AF. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. KRNN is on 872 and KXLL is on 873. And we're online continuously streaming from www.ktoo.org. Juneau Afternoon will be preempted on Monday because of the coverage of the inaugural address. The inaugural events will be carried on KTOO live from Washington, D.C.